From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Nan, the show connecting your neighborhood with the world. From microaggressions to cultural appropriation, we live in a society that is more acutely aware than ever of language and actions that can be deemed offensive. At first blush, one would assume a society beholden to political correctness would be beneficial to everyone. But that concept has been under attack this year. Many see the idea of political correctness as getting in the way of an open cultural discourse and preventing the free flow of ideas. As protests sweep across the country's college campuses, students and the media are grappling with how to talk about the tough issues without creating emotional strife for certain members of the community. But exactly how important is it to be politically correct, and how can you deal with someone making offensive remarks in your workplace? Here to talk about all of this, of course, is Howard Ross, because he is a workplace diversity consultant, and he's a principal at Cook Ross. Howard, always a pleasure.
Same to you, Kojo, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Let's start with the basics. What does it mean to be politically correct?
Well, I think it's a term that has various meanings to various people. When the whole notion of political correctness came into our lexicon, I would say back in the 1980s, early 1980s, it generally meant to watch for language that might be considered patently offensive to certain people, language that had gotten itself embedded in our culture over a period of time that might have been outdated because of changes in our understanding of equality, understanding of things like privilege in the culture. What's happened now is that political correctness has become sort of a canard for people to say, anytime that I can't say anything I want that's offensive to people, it's political correctness. And so there's, what had been a relatively targeted thing is now used broadly by everybody for anything.
During the first hour of this broadcast today, we discussed the debate over whether the term PG portrays Prince George's County in a negative light. How much power do simple labels like that have over the way we approach ideas? This discussion we had in a generally lighthearted way, and that discussion is generally conducted in a lighthearted way, but a lot of people, especially officials appointed and elected in Prince George's County, take it very seriously. They feel that the abbreviation is, in a way, offensive to them.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that's a great example. I mean, we can look at Prince George's County as a good example of the essence of this conversation, because the reason many people feel that way is because I grew up in this area. I went to the University of Maryland. It used to be PG County, and PG County had a particular demographic to it. It had a particular socioeconomic basis to it. It was known for example, an enormous amount of racism, that sort of thing. Now, of course, Prince George's County is one of the most vital upper middle class African American communities in the country, and it's a very different place than it was then. And so, the desire to name it differently is really goes along with the desire to be seen differently as a county. For people outside, it seems like a silly distinction, but for people inside the county, it's a way of saying we're not that county that you thought about. And I think if we look at how this language is used, language has huge impact on people. I mean, it's no accident, for example, that the language of marriage equality was more successful than gay marriage. For example, back in when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was still being debated, CNN, I believe it was a CNN poll that showed, they asked people, do you believe that homosexuals should be allowed to serve in the military, and roughly around 60% said that they agreed that they should. Then they said, do you believe that gay people should be allowed to serve in the military? And 13 or 14% more people said so. So that change in language means something to people, and the dance is between how are we careful with using language and what do we mean, but not have it also suffocate conversations.
800-433-8850. We're talking with Howard Ross. Do you speak up when someone says something that offends you? Do you think people in media are being too politically correct? And if so, how? 800-433-8850. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Certain language is considered politically incorrect because it offends some number of people. But the targets of disparaging speech can have very different reactions. Some people tend to be more easily offended than others. Why?
Well, I mean, look, it's like anything else. So we have our differences in the way we react to things based on what they trigger in us personally. And, I mean, Kojo, if you look, just for example, in the African-American or the Black American community, that we have people who grew up in the United States who are African-American, and you have people who, like yourself, grew up outside of the United States in either the Caribbean or Africa, who might have very different reactions. I remember a good friend in the city who is from West Africa, very, very dark-skinned man, but he grew up in wealth and privilege in his culture. It came to this country to go to school and ended up staying here. And I'll never forget talking with him when I first met him and seeing his reaction to racism, which was so qualitatively different than most African Americans. It was almost like fool. You know, it just didn't get in because the inner conversation that he had growing up in a culture in which he saw lots of people like him be successful was very different than people who grew up in this culture. So similarly, our reaction to these words has a lot to do with what they trigger in us, with sensitivity that they trigger in us.
The term political correctness is a relatively new entry into the mainstream American discourse. It's helped lead to the idea that there's a generational divide when it comes to this issue. Are we seeing millennials take political correctness to heart more than older generations did?
Well, I think that there have been waves of it. For example, if you look at college campuses and what's going on now, and there are waves of it. And there's a fascinating piece in The Atlantic written by Jonathan Haidt, who's a NYU professor, mm-hmm. and Greg Lukianoff, who works in free speech, and talking about the impact of our current political correctness environment on college campuses. And the point that they make, both of them coming from what we might call a more liberal perspective, nonetheless say that the challenge is we're now creating environments where we're taking away from students the need to learn how to deal with the everyday slights that they encounter in life. So we're trying to create these sanitized environments where we can't talk about anything, for lack of saying the wrong thing. So there, I read somewhere, for example, that there was a professor at University of California who got called up, so to speak, because he said to his class, America is the land of opportunity, and he had violated the rules of political correctness by, first of all, saying America as opposed to the United States, and secondly, because it's not the land of opportunity for everybody. Now, I don't disagree with either of those points, but to have somebody called up or brought to whatever kind of accountability for a statement as innocuous as that, one would have to question, are we getting to the point where we have to watch our words so carefully that we can't even have conversations?
Glad you mentioned that piece by Jonathan Haidt, because they've called the desire for political correctness on college campuses illiberal because it limits free expression. How much, if any, of a chilling effect on free speech do you think a politically correct campus culture has?
Well, I think it's tremendously troubling. I've always been somebody personally who believed that no matter how odious somebody was, that the risk of suppressing people's speech is higher than the risk of somebody saying something stupid and offending somebody else, or saying something hurtful and offending somebody else. That doesn't mean I like to hear it, but there's a difference between not liking to hear something, turning your back and walking away from somebody you don't want to listen to, versus banning somebody. And this is the real challenge we have. And unfortunately, what we don't realize is often, what we don't remember is that which we find offensive is very clear to us, but that we may be the one who's found offensive by others. And if we get into the situation where we're restricting free speech because we don't like what they're saying, they may just as easily turn around and do the same thing to us. And that the nature of our discourse in our country is being really limited by the fact that people are increasingly listening to people who only sound like them. And you and I have talked about this relative to the bifurcation of the media, that, you know, if you watch your station and read your blogs and go on your Facebook page, all you see is your point of view. And it's contributing dramatically, I believe, to the polarization that we're seeing in our political discourse.
800-433-8850. From Missouri to Yale to Princeton, universities have begun to see protests over issues from constant harassment on campus to glorification of racially insensitive former President Woodrow Wilson. Why are college campuses the place. Why are they so ripe for this kind of action?
Well, I think they're for a couple of reasons. First of all, because they are places where intellectual discourse is encouraged. And so there are not many places in life where we have as much time as we do when we're in college to sit around and ponder these kinds of things. You know, once you get into the work world, you're getting up every day, you're going to work, you're doing what you have to do. And you don't have time to, you know, to sort of engage as much. Secondly, I think that there's something about the young energy that we bring when we're that age, that energy of inquiry combined with some adolescent rebellion that's still part of our systems, and you and I remember that very well, which is you know, one of the great things about college campuses and how they've contributed so often to whether it's the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement or any number of other movements in our society, because of the fact that all those things were there. But it also means that we can become very sophomoric and righteous, self-righteous about our point of view. And in an environment where liberalism is the key, and, you know, again, I consider myself a progressive, so I'm very comfortable in those environments, but I have, doing a lot of work on college campuses, have heard any number of conservative professors talk about the fact that they're sometimes nervous about what they say in front of certain people.
People want to shut them down.
That's
completely.
Right. That's right.
On to the telephones. Here's Nick in Winchester, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you, Kojo. What I said to Danielle was that we all have terms that we react to negatively. But it seems to me we don't necessarily have a right to make society change because we have that reaction. I don't like being called a redneck. By the same token, the terminology for African Americans in my lifetime has changed from colored to Negro to black to African American. And, for example, I can remember both Joe Biden and Harry Reid being criticized because they said they referred to President Obama as a Negro. I think that's absurd. They've gone through the same changes that I've gone through, and you forget which term you should be using. And at the same time, I think minorities, whether it's African Americans in the United States or Scots in Scotland, have a right to have their preferences.
Well, you raise a number of interesting issues that I know Howard wants to respond to, but I'll just touch on one of them. You said you don't like being called a redneck. And as you know, there was at least one very famous white comedian who has built a career out of calling himself a redneck and projecting that image. And it reminded me of very many, many years ago in one of his early books, called by the N-word, Dick Gregory said, some white person said to him, "You call yourselves the N-word all the time, but if I called you that, you'd be upset." No, he said, "You'd be hurt." And which Dick Gregory responded, "No, if you called me that, you'd be hurt,
right?" Exactly.
So go ahead, Howard.
Well, I think, there are a couple things here. I think that, Nick, I think that you're bringing up some really good points. I mean, I think that one of the things that we have to look at is when we use this terminology, what's the intention behind it? I think it's important we create a distinction here between political correctness as it was originally intended, which is to say, what do these words mean and what do they connote, and should we use different words that connote a different reality, to what we're now seeing, which is the political correctness, as I said before, being used as a canard by people like Donald Trump and others to mean, I can say whatever the hell I want to say, no matter how rude, no matter how offensive, no matter how insulting, racist, bigoted, or whatever else, and you can't question me because of quote political corrective, because you're just being politically correct. And so rather than looking at it from the standpoint of what does language mean and how does it impact people, which was its original intention, is now a way to justify my lack of being civil in civil discourse. And that's confusing for people. And you know, particularly there's some people on the extreme right who are, you know, beating this drum all the time that any attention to the needs of people who might be in a non-dominant group is, quote, political correctness. And so I think we need to separate that from a more thoughtful conversation, the kinds of things that Nick was talking about. there, like you said, Koji, there are people who claim the language. Richard Pryor was one who famously did this. He did it with the N-word. He claimed that language because in the claiming of that language, and Jewish comedians did it years ago, and by doing that, it desensitizes people. But that is different when it's coming out of a different mouth, a different face, a different identity. It's one thing for somebody who's black to use the N-word in that kind of a way. It's something else entirely for somebody who's white to use it. And for us, to put that in context, think of it this way. There are things that that you may say jokingly about yourself, making fun of one of your foibles or a flaw that you see in yourself, that you may say or even talk about in yourself. Whereas if somebody else pointed it out to you, it would feel very different than if you were claiming it for yourself. And this is no different than that. Or something that you and or my wife and I might say to each other in our home that would be very different if we said it in front of other people. You know, so it's important for us to recognize that words matter. They have impact.
Richard Pryor famously stopped using the word after he made a trip to Africa and said that what he saw over there were a lot of black people who looked like himself, but he saw no N-word people whatsoever.
Right. That's
so he stopped using the word.
That's right.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, if you have calls, stay on the line, and a lot of you have. If you're trying to get through and the lines are busy, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Or if you get through on the phone, you can talk to that Danielle person our last caller talked about because Danielle Brown is our call screener. 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. Our guest is Howard Ross. He's a frequent guest. He's a workplace diversity consultant and a principal at Coke Ross. We're talking about political correctness and how it has been used and how it is now under attack. Inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Are people more easily offended, in your view, than they once were? You can also go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. Howard, on college campuses, there's been a push to add trigger warnings to syllabi to warn students about material that may lead to a strong emotional response, such as material dealing with racial violence or sexual abuse. To what degree do you think these tools are helpful for the student population?
Well, you know, all things in moderation, including moderation. I mean, I think that, you know, the challenge with these kinds of ideas is that they make a lot of sense, just like it makes sense for us to sometimes put a warning in front of a news broadcast that this will show violent images or something like that. And we definitely, you know, there's some times when that makes sense. The challenge is it's gone to the extreme. And so, you know, any mention of a particular thing which might require us to talk about what actually happened in a historical context. So if there was a rape, for example, in that historical context, or if there was mass rape in some cases as groups of people came into another area and did that, you know, let's use as an example the comfort women, the Japanese turning Koreans women into comfort women, that sort of thing, then the reaction sometimes is, well, we can't talk about this, so we have to warn people we're talking about it. And the point that Haidt and Lukianoff make, which I think is a really good one, is that it gets to the point of potentially of coddling people and not preparing them for dealing with real life. So if we live in these environments in which every word is parsed so that we're never having to confront things that are upsetting to us, what happens when you get out into real life and you are confronting on a daily basis things that are upsetting? As opposed to having people engage in dialogue or discourse about what does that bring up for you, what emotional feelings does it cause, what reactions does it have you have, and how might that affect the way you think, feel, and act. And those are the kinds of conversations that are healthy conversations. We're actually looking at what's there and seeing how we react to it.
I was reading a defense of the trigger warnings by Kate Mann, a philosophy professor at Cornell, who's been using trigger warnings in her teaching. She says they've been adapted to serve a subtly different purpose within universities. Increasingly, professors like me simply give students notice in their syllabuses or before certain reading assignments. The point is not to enable, let alone encourage students to skip those readings or our subsequent class discussion. Rather, it is to allow those who are sensitive to these subjects to prepare themselves for reading about them and better manage their reactions.
Yeah, and that's what I was saying about a moderate approach. I mean, I think that's completely reasonable. We're going to be talking about this issue. It's an issue that sometimes brings up stuff. Pay attention to that. Be aware of that. look at how that affects the way you're dealing with the material. That's an instructive and a helpful tool because it can teach them not only to do that in the moment, but also continually in life. I think where it gets dangerous is when we say, we're not going to say this, or we're not going to do this, or there's an interpretation of a particular language or act in the in a context which may not be consistent with people's intentions. So I was talking to somebody at a campus not long ago. I was at a medical school, and they told me about people had gotten angry with them because they came up to a fellow student who, I don't remember what country the fellow student had come from, but they said, "Where do you come from?" which a lot of people consider to be a microaggression, which is another terminology we can talk about.
Yes.
And they said, well, you know, that's a microaggression. Why would you assume that I'm not from the United States? And actually, he said, actually, I was thinking, well, I came from Detroit. I was wondering where they came from. And he was actually sort of nonplussed by the whole thing. I think there are times when the lack of understanding of intention gets in the way. Also, there's not a lot of clarity between when somebody has innocently said something that may be dated or rub somebody the wrong way versus when somebody's using it, as in the case of somebody like Trump, to be intentionally hurtful.
A lot of people want to join the conversation, but before we go to the phones or emails or tweets again, you mentioned microaggressions. Displays of political incorrectness are rarely explicitly racist. Instead, they often take the form of microaggressions. What are microaggressions, and what kind of impact can they have on people?
Well, microaggression is a language that's been sort of updated lately about a concept that was first created in 1971 by a woman named Anita Rowe, who was the ombudsperson at MIT. She talked about micro inequities, micro behaviors that subtly advantage or disadvantage certain people. So you could have a micro advantage, for example, if somebody gives you a second chance to answer a question and they haven't given somebody else a second chance. You could have a micro inequity if somebody's not paying as close attention to you as they would somebody else. And we know these are patterns of subtle bias that occur. More recently, the term microaggression has sort of amped that up a bit. And conceptually, I think it's something we have to pay attention to, because in today's world, most racism, most sexism, most bias
is not explicit.
Doesn't show up explicitly or overtly, or at least it hasn't until this presidential campaign. And mostly, they are things that subtly occur. The challenge I have with the language of microaggression is that the term aggression is almost always interpreted as being conscious. And overwhelmingly, most of these micro behaviors are unconscious. And so if you come to me and I've engaged in a behavior that I wasn't even aware I was engaging in, and you accuse me of being aggressive with it, my tendency will be defensive. So just from the standpoint of increasing dialogue, which is what I think is the most important thing always, I think that that language can sometimes be off-putting. But conceptually, it's important for us to recognize that a lot of the little things that do grind on people, exceedingly small, as our friend Julian would say, are the kinds of things that are not overt, they're not in and of themselves significant, but combined with 30 or 40 or 50 other things that week like that can have that grinding effect on people.
On to the phones. Here is Deborah in Washington, D.C. Deborah, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. So I want to talk about what I think. I think that for a lot of people, the whole idea that society is becoming too PC is a red herring. And particularly on college campuses, you know, I think we can always find examples of, let's say, a more conservative professor that feels a little bit nervous about saying what he wants to say and teaching the way he wants to teach. But I think that's pretty far outnumbered by, you know, instances over history where history has been taught erroneously, or, you know, historical facts are not being presented correctly. And they can be very offensive to people. And I think that, you know, in a situation, let's take Princeton University, you know, if it turns out that, you know, the history tells us that Woodrow Wilson was, you know, systematically, you know, trying to...
he resegregated the civil service.
Right. Resegregate the civil service. Then, you know, if that history needs to come out, and I think people at Princeton, students at Princeton, have a right to say, we don't necessarily want to honor that. And I have a strong feeling that even if they change the name of Woodrow Wilson College or whatever, the University of Princeton and the institution of Princeton is going to weather that just fine, and I don't think it's going to be the end of the world as we know it, as a lot of conservatives would have people believe that, you know, PC is going to change, you know.
Well, you raise a fascinating question that I'd like to hear Howard respond to, and that is, or a variety of fascinating questions. Mm-hmm. One is educating people on the campus as to who Woodrow Wilson really was, rather than the mythical figure that they have now come to respect so much, telling the truth about all dimensions of who Woodrow Wilson really was. The second, of course, is what do you do about that?
Yeah, I think, Deborah, I agree with you on the whole. My question, you know, that I think is important is where is the degree? You know, where is the point where something becomes excessive or suffocating? Wilson is a great example. You know, Wilson is somebody who was not just somebody who was of his time. He was a virulent racist who supported in both clandestine and not so clandestine ways the KKK, who tried to ratchet back segregation, who even said he thought that the 13th and 14th Amendments were inappropriate. So, you know, and yet we see him, of course, in a historical context of many other things that he did. John C. Calhoun is another character on Princeton campus. They've had the same thing. John C. Calhoun, who fought for slavery. On the other hand, I have seen places where people have said that Abraham Lincoln's name shouldn't be mentioned because there are texts in which he says that that blacks, I believe that he used the term Negroes in the quote, but would never be the equal to whites, were incapable of being the equal to whites, and which was, of course, a widely believed thought at that time by almost all white people, with the exception of very few. So what's the difference between the two? And that's where it becomes very hairy. You know, how do we make the determination between somebody who is overtly racist and who actually tried to ratchet back the development versus somebody who was evolving and, in fact, ended up doing some of the most important things in race relations in our country? And it's the absolutism or the orthodoxy of that that I think can get us in trouble.
Thank you very much for your call, Deborah. Here's an email we got from Jordan, who writes, I'm a college student at a rather socially progressive university. As I see the rise of such incidents of censorship on college campuses, I feel like a hive mind is being created. A lot of people who say allegedly offensive things have the right to do so, and the good part about that is that we as peers have just as much freedom to explain why such things are damaging. Offensive speech should be seen as an opportunity to teach, not attack. When we censor so hastily, we're teaching people that they do not have to explain why anything is wrong and can simply just curtail it. One of the points that Jonathan Haidt was making is that in countries that follow the path of communism or Marxism-Leninism, that in those countries, the speech that was in opposition to whatever the party line happened to be was considered offensive speech. And for those people, he said, who would say that these party liners were just being oppressive, you have to remember that these societies, the people who created these societies, were fighting against some pretty rough social and political and economic oppression themselves.
Yeah, that's true. And that's, of course, in the extreme what we're afraid of. It goes back to Orwell, 1984, Newspeak, you know, mm-hmm. that certain things you could and couldn't say. And this is, of course, the danger. And repressive governments, certainly over the course of history, have operated somewhat by restricting things people could even talk about. The notion being, if you can't talk about it and you stop thinking about it, then it will stop existing. And at the same time, as Deborah was saying, there are people who have been trained in a history which has those things embedded in it, and we have to look at it and how language changes over time. Just as another example, being a lesbian, gay, or bisexual, transgender, or questioning, is that a sexual orientation or is it a sexual preference? Now, some people would say whatever, but it's not whatever because it's actually a very different understanding of and belief about what sexual orientation means to people. And so when somebody says sexual preference, that comes from a historical belief that people could just choose that no matter, or it was a lifestyle choice as opposed to a real orientation towards life. The question is, if somebody says that, let's say, you know, somebody who's 70 years old and grew up in a different environment, says sexual preference, should they be attacked for it, or should they be given feedback how that hits the person they're talking to? Let me tell you how that sounds to me and why my preference would be that you would use a different terminology. And that's where we get into trouble. Does this make you bad? Does this make you evil? Does this make you one of them? Or is this a way for us to clarify our discourse and actually be clear what we're talking about?
And now that I've seen research saying that scientific research saying that the brain in and of itself does not reflect gender, mm-hmm. it makes it a little more complicated for
exactly.
people to understand.
Yes, exactly.
Here is Michael in Fairfax, Virginia. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Gentlemen, good to hear from you today. I really appreciate this guest today taking what can be a highly intellectualized or scholastic topic and making it digestible and hearable for a lot of people. It seems easy to comprehend, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Look, I want to say a kind of big thing, and I'm going to try to compress it as much as I can. So, look, the history of humanity is one of constant and inexorable liberalization. As we look at ourselves now in this iteration, at this time, and with this topic, that topic of are we getting too PC for our own good, I think if you go to the next level, you can see what we're really expressing here is this communal desire that authority dictate for us the social mores and ethics that we as a group unquestionably should be following. If you think about the last couple of decades, there have been sting operations on TV shows about bullying, putting somebody in a situation where they can see at the next table or with the next group or something highly inappropriate is happening. Are they going to step in? Are they going to step up? Are they going to say something? Are they going to walk away? Right? I think the same thing is going on here. Rather than the individual speaking into that space and saying, this is wrong, or I don't agree with it, and then having the conversation that comes with that, whatever it may be.
Authority.
We are looking for the administration, the authority, the school, whatever it might be, the government, to set the standard, and everybody should follow.
Allow me to have Howard Ross respond to that, because he raises another issue here. We talked about trigger warnings. So-called safe spaces on campus are talked about mostly in regard to college campuses. Have you ever seen them make their way into any other kinds of workplace? And is that an example of authority being used to, in fact, prevent offensive speech?
Just a second, Coach. But first, sure. I want to say, Michael, I think your assessment is right on point. That this is what people are really asking for. They're asking for some structure, some authority, some governing body or people to say, we are now certifying that this is the cultural mores we're living in today. These are the norms of the culture. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think getting back to your point, Kojo, absolutely. I mean, I think that this shows up every day in people's interactions with each other. What is it safe to say in a business? How do we talk about certain issues? Am I going to say the wrong word and therefore be branded a racist or a sexist or whatever? You know, you hear people talking. I've seen white people talking, and they'll say, hey, you know, Kojo Nnamdi, you know, he's the guy over at WAMU. He's black. Like, you don't know you are. And the fear of even saying the words or things, particularly in our Twitterized culture now being taken out of context. I said one great example of that was, if you remember back a number of months ago, I think it was after the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, that Mark Cuban was interviewed at a conference, and they asked him about it, and he said, We all have bias. He says, if I'm walking down the street and I see a young man with a hoodie, a young African-American man with a hoodie, or a white guy who looks like a skinhead, I'm going to cross the street and get away from them. And he went on to say that as a leader of a business, I've got to take care of managing my own biases and learn how to do that. We've got to train our leaders to be able to do that so it doesn't get in the way of them doing things effectively.
Well, people didn't hear the last part, though.
The problem was, all they heard was, if I see a young black man with a hood on, I'm going to cross the street. And that was what got flashed over the internet a million times, and all of a sudden Cuban had to back off of a statement which most people would say was a pretty progressive statement in terms of how to deal with these things and what kind of things we want leaders to use. And so the combination of the soundbite culture we're living in has contributed a lot to this as well. But on a daily basis in organizations, people are hesitant to talk about these issues when they need to be talked about.
Got to take a short break. If you've called, stay on the line. We'll try to get to your calls. If you're trying to get through, send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or a tweet at @KojoShow. How should colleges handle the topic of political correctness? You can also go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Welcome back. We're talking with Howard Ross about political correctness. He's a workplace diversity consultant and a principal at the firm Cook Ross. Before we get back to the phones, the protests at Yale have centered around a staff member in a residential college who supported students that complained that the administration had imposed tight restrictions on what they could and could not wear. In writing for The Atlantic, Connor Friedersdorf called the costumes, quoting here, a cause that misguided campus activists mistook for a social justice priority. How important is an issue like Halloween attire when talking about creative and creating an inclusive community?
Well, I think it's the same thing as we've been talking about, Coach. I think that, you know, where is the line drawn? There are certain circumstances where people might wear costumes to a particular gathering of people where the costumes are intended to have a particular theme. Then there are other times when those costumes, they leave that very event and go somewhere else, and that might be seen as offensive in that other environment. I think that the real challenge is, again, what's the intention, and what's, and you know, how is the message delivered? Now, if there are certain things which, you know, for example, I could completely understand where a college or university wouldn't want people walking around in Ku Klux Klan outfits, even if it was part of something, that it would be smart not to have them walking around campus, because we have a history that says these are people who killed people in our culture, who killed them in horrific ways.
And if you have on that campus African American students who are thinking, okay, I was enslaved, segregated against, lynched, and now I'm being mocked?
Yes, and not only that, but it may very well have been a member of my family. This is like real time, you know, mm-hmm. or the same thing true for Nazis, for, you know, that sort of thing. And so it's completely appropriate in those kinds of settings to say that we don't want you to do this. And if somebody does that in the face of that, then the question has to be asked, given something as blatant as that, what are you trying to communicate and what's your purpose here? And I think that that's, in extreme cases, that's completely appropriate. Now, then there's the huge gray area in the middle, and that's the problem, is what happens in the gray area and who gets to make those determinations.
The criticism of political correctness has mostly come from the right. Current GOP frontrunner Donald Trump has especially embraced this attitude. The message seems to have struck a chord with conservatives. We got an email from Maxine who says, it's one thing to make disparaging references that seek to be inflammatory or insulting. It's quite another when people must walk on eggshells and police everything they think or say. It's this instance of political correctness that has fueled folks like Donald Trump, because he's not afraid to open his mouth and utter just about anything. People will support him as a backlash, even if his rhetoric is ridiculous. There's nothing worse than a neocon than a neolib. I guess the person wants to say there's nothing worse than a neocon as a neolib.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Trump has really taken this issue and caused a lot of confusion, because what Trump is really a bully who makes bigoted statements almost daily, and who he does it coming from a complete lack of self-censorship. And anytime anybody doesn't like it, his canard once again is, well, that's political correctness. No, it's a lack of civility, in the very same sense as Justopher Holmes said that you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. I mean, what Donald Trump is doing now has gone beyond being a carnival barker. He's now practicing demagoguery. He's consciously and willfully stirring up the violent impulses of people in our culture and the hateful impulses of people in our culture. And because he's the number one person in the Republican primary right now, of course, those numbers look big. So we look at 30%, and in fact, that probably represents about 14% of the population or less. So we're talking about a select group of people who are supporting Trump now, who resonate with that because they're angry, they feel disaligned, they feel like they're not being heard, or any number of reasons that lots of people have talked about. But I think it's important that we recognize that we don't define the conversation about political correctness based on Donald Trump's behavior.
We got an email from Melissa that's kind of long, so I probably won't be able to read it all. Melissa says, I am Arab-American, though am told that I look white, and being told that speaks volumes on what those that say it think. I was approached by a total stranger in a common area of a hotel while on vacation, who let me know his rather frightening opinion of Arabs, Muslims, terrorists. He kept interchanging the words. I didn't say anything, as I knew he didn't know I was Arab-American, as I actually feared for my safety with the venom he was spewing. Too many people have been injured and killed for normal activities that offended the crazies. This included the waitress who was shot and killed at a Waffle House for daring to tell a customer that the restaurant was no smoking, to the woman who was assaulted by another customer with a beer mug for daring to, and it goes on like that.
Yeah. Well, what Melissa's describing is overtly bigoted, uncivil behavior. And that's behavior that's inappropriate. It has really not much to do with political correctness as much as it has to do with civility. And the challenge is that, of course, there are many people who would say that if that person isn't saying those things, are you any safer than you are that he is saying them? That's a whole other question, and people have different opinions about that. I think that, you know, most of us, hopefully, most of us in this country would say that we don't want people being accosted like that because of their identity, whatever the identity is. I thought the president spoke to this very clearly yesterday evening. That we have to stop this fear from becoming the way we identify certain members of our population. And, you know, the whole notion of Islamophobia is a great example of that, because people have no understanding whatsoever about the 1.5 billion Muslims in this world and how few of them are Arabs and how few of them are radicals and how few of them are any of the things we're talking about. And yet all of it gets thrown into a stereotype.
Here now is John, or Joe, in Manassas, Virginia. Sorry about that, Joe. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no problem. I think we really need to understand what really is going on here. I'm a product of two Ivy League schools, universities, 2 degrees. I was a faculty member at another university for a couple of years. The whole political correctness, and I know you're not supposed to generalize, we're all supposed to be open-minded and blah, 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 but it really is an effort of the left to stifle conservative thought and politics that they don't like. And let me give you a couple of examples. It takes zero, and I mean almost absolute zero, courage in about 90% of the universities to be a liberal who assumes that if you don't like affirmative action, you're a racist. If you support free market economics, you hate poor people. And I fought that for years. I campaigned for Reagan when I was a freshman in an Ivy League school. And you want to see hate and venom and stuff, then you'd be a conservative in an Ivy League school. That takes courage. But, my God, a microaggression, you know, this whole thing about what are microaggressions, all we're doing is giving a class of people who are really whiners, and I don't care what their politics are, but they're just a bunch of whiners, and they want to be able to stifle debate without talking about facts. If you say hands up, don't shoot, never happened, when it was proven that it didn't happen, you're a racist. And you know, look, try to go to a dinner party in Washington or New York and speak something conservative unless you're, you know, at a conservative function.
Okay, well,
all know darn well that this is just an effort by the left to stifle political speech.
Did you say, Joe, also that you taught in college?
Yes. Well, I was a faculty member. I did research. I never had a teacher.
For how long?
2 years.
Oh, okay.
I actually had professors underneath me. I ran a division. And I'll tell you, talk about the most closed-minded, nastiest environments are in universities.
A quick question before Howard Ross responds. Did you feel that you were run off the campus? Were you ever silenced?
I was run off. I wrote an article once saying that the biggest problem in Africa was not in South Africa, where 600 people were getting killed per year because of the terrible policies of South Africa, but maybe in Burundi, where 2 million people were getting killed by the government. I had death threats. I had to change my phone number. All this other kind of stuff.
Okay, here's Howard Ross.
Yeah, Joe, we don't mean to interrupt. We just have the time limit.
We don't have a lot of time left.
Yeah. I think, first of all, Joe, I want to be really clear. I'm sympathetic to what you're saying relative to being a conservative in a highly liberal university environment. I think that exact thing can happen to people, and I've spoken to people for whom it happens. I do think, though, the main thing I would challenge what you're saying is this notion that political correctness only lives on the liberal side of the equation. I think if you watch Fox News, I would challenge you to see whether there are times when people are fully allowed to express the other side of the view there, or when you go into very, very highly conservative environments, what would happen if somebody would say, you know, I don't think Obama's all that bad. What would people say then? I think the challenge is that now we've associated the term political correctness with more the liberal or progressive side, but the same kind of suppression of the discourse occurs on both sides of this political equation. And for me, that's the greatest danger. I think what's happened is that our way of dealing with these issues has gravitated towards the extremes of the conversation on both sides. And what we've lost is the ability for well-intentioned, solid thinking people to understand that some people can have a conservative point of view with a deep commitment to justice and fairness for people and a great society, and some people can have a liberal or progressive point of view with that same commitment and disagree on strategy, tactics, or what kinds of things can work. For example, your example about affirmative action. And if we continue to brand the things that don't fit into our belief system as wrong or evil simply because they disagree with us, as opposed to things that are truly hurtful, then what we lose is the power that comes from people really working to draw the best from both sides and come up with solutions.
As a workplace diversity consultant, you value the importance of having people from different backgrounds and with different ideas working together in one place. And while your work is primarily about creating inclusive communities, a lot of people in the academic world consider having a politicized atmosphere a necessary element for a fulfilling learning experience. Do you see what I would call doing battle in the arena of ideas as a significant benefit of diversity?
Well, I think it is very much so. And I mean, if you look at John Haidt's work, for example, you know, one of the guys who wrote the article from NYU, Haidt has done some really remarkable work in unpacking what are the philosophical underpinnings of conservatives and liberalism, for example. And he says that if you really look at it, just as a couple quick examples, conservatives tend to focus more on security and loyalty issues. Liberals tend to focus more on equity and fairness and relief of people's pain or stopping people from being hurt. Well, both of those are important, but we have different amounts of concern about each of those, as we see right now, the concern about fairness for Muslim Americans versus the safety issue. You know, mm-hmm. When we put both together, when we can actually be in discourse around those in the ways you're talking about on college campuses, we come up with some remarkable ways to deal with issues that address issues of security, but also address issues of fairness and equity, for example. And I think that the challenge is when we brand everything as not the kind of thing we talk about, is that we lose that opportunity. And I think that the loss of that free speech, the free thought of that, is in a lot of cases far more dangerous than simply the use of a particular word.
Here's Michael in Springfield, Virginia. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to start by saying, kind of addressing a previous caller who called the issue a red herring. I don't think it is, because it's sort of built a new issue in and of itself. College professors are getting fired. Students are getting thrown off campus for just simply for speech issues. And I can sort of preface this with an anecdote myself. I'm not straight. I have anxiety and depression, so I understand what it's like to be triggered by things. And those well-intended college students, I understand a lot of their concern, but as an educator myself, I view learning as happening in a dialogic way. It takes more than one view to learn something. And college-level discourse should necessarily be uncomfortable at times. And
I say it should necessarily be uncomfortable at times?
Yes, that's right. Furthermore, I think people have a right to make a fool out of themselves, and we're probably better off knowing who the fools are by letting them speak anyway.
Here's Howard Russ. Howard, you have about a minute left.
Yeah, I agree, Michael. I think that that's exactly at the heart of the conversation. I think the heart of the conversation is how can we really fully understand where each other are coming from more. I mean, I make a point now, as I did last night after the president's speech, to watch multiple news stations. It's painful sometimes. It's uncomfortable sometimes. And I don't like to hear what people have to say sometimes. But invariably, there will be a point that's made on the other side of the equation that helps me understand better why they see the world that way. And as I'm working with people to try to find solutions to some of the challenges that they face in their work environment. If we can get more of that information, we have a better chance of finding solutions that work for everybody.
Michael, thank you very much for your call. Howard Ross is a workplace diversity consultant and a principal at the firm Cook Ross. Howard, always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.